Hello and welcome to the Eclipsing History Podcast, a podcast where we explore the history of eclipses through the diverse cultures of North America.
This is episode 5, Eclipsing Emotions. You can find the entire series and additional information at vgsu.edu/eclipsinghistory.
Welcome back to the Eclipsing History Podcast. Throughout this series, you have learned about science, tourism, folklore, and power. For this fifth and final show, Eclipsing Emotions, we will discuss the history of emotions and how we see them evolve with modern understandings of eclipses. I'm Alana Graves, joined with my two co-hosts, Hope London and Trenton Nelson. For this episode, we would like you to think about if emotions change over time. Are they biological constants or social constructions? Do emotions alter over time, or is it merely that the names change? Imagine, it is 1991. You've lived in Mexico your whole life. The weather is average, hot, the people are familiar, your friends, and the sky is clear, blue. But July 11th is not a typical day. You see the sky fading to black as people start to yell.
Al principio, pues bueno, como acá la tradición, pues bueno.
Well, at the beginning, following our ancestral tradition, our grandparents used to tell us that eclipses were a bad omen. They believed it was a punishment from our father, you know? So they said that on that day, or at that moment, we had to be cautious, they said. They said that when it gets dark during the day, the stones turn into snakes, or the shoes you have can harm you because they transform into some kind of animal. That's what they used to tell us, you know? So practically, I hadn't experienced any eclipse throughout my entire life, from the day I was born until that day in 1991. So I had a little fear and curiosity at the same time, you know? I wanted to see what would happen. The experience in some ways was exciting. So, well, it took like 2 minutes, I think, of total darkness. Because of that, we stayed inside our house. We were a bit afraid to be outside. Well, yeah, maybe a fear of the unknown, you know? And I thought, what if the demon really comes out and catches us? So we were, well, you could say, taking shelter in the house, right, with our family, talking quietly, saying, how does it look? How do you feel? We were chatting with the family who were there, which was my family mainly. And that was the experience I had. And we saw that the stars normal as if it were nighttime, right? And the birds and chickens, they all went up to the trees for refuge. Well, as I mentioned, we weren't allowed to look directly because they told us that it was not recommended to look directly at the sun. The only thing we did was watch it on television because they were broadcasting it.
This was the experience of Esteban Rios. These feelings of confusion, anxiety, and fear are not exclusive to the Audom or those living in Mexico. Cheryl Dong recounts similar traditions from her childhood in China.
One of the stories that my father would tell me when I was a little girl was that in China, when he was a kid, and this was like during the Cultural Revolution, people would go on the rooftops in the village when there was an eclipse and kind of bang pots and pans and set off firecrackers. And it was in some ways like a party, something that he kind of remembered in a very fun and nostalgic kind of way. And the way that he explained it was that they were poor villagers. They didn't know any better. And that the folktales told them that an eclipse was the dog, a celestial dog eating the sun. So I think in a way, my father felt a lot of shame about thinking that, especially he would frame it later on as, well, when I went to college and I knew better, I understood how stupid that was. But I also think that as a little bit of folk knowledge, it's something that's very interesting and really makes sense. If you're living in rural China, a story like that helps give you agency, right? During a celestial phenomenon that you have no control over. But the idea that by banging pots and pans on the roof, by setting off firecrackers, you can scare away something that is so potentially dangerous, is a way to really take back the power.
From North to South America and all the way to Asia, it is clear that numerous cultures share similar stories of fear-based coping during eclipses. Was it their unpredictability that caused such stressed responses? The lack of scientific research or general knowledge? Or just the simple fact that looking at an eclipse without protection is dangerous and painful? Across centuries, people have reported their feelings of anxiety and disappointment while witnessing eclipses.
By listening to the childhood stories of Dr. Cheryl Dong and Esteban Rios, it becomes evident that although we may be aware of our surroundings and the science behind eclipses, it does not mean that the fear is taken away. Having knowledge does not equate to not being anxious or even excited about eclipse when it comes around. There is a power to accepting and understanding your emotions, having the authority to be excited, to perceive nature in the way that is true to you.
Stories like these show that eclipse viewing, even when there's a general understanding of scientific knowledge, can be both negatively and positively revered in tandem. From fear to anguish, regret and shame, emotions evolve with time and universal acceptance of celestial events. This does not mean that those experiences are invalidated by our modern understandings of eclipses. On the contrary, actually, we can now relate these negative feelings with tangible evidence, such as eclipses having effects on rivers, eyesight, and colors. It makes more sense that both people of the past and present would hold fear-based traditions close to their hearts during these stressful yet awe-inspiring occurrences. Astronomy enthusiast Frank Dempsey's experience with eclipse chasing highlights this.
The first eclipse I saw was in Baja, Mexico in 1991, and that was relatively nearby in terms of not requiring travel to other side of the world or whatever. It was relatively easy because a local astronomy group in Toronto, near Toronto here, organized a 48-hour long charter flight from Toronto to part of Mexico and then a bus trip down to the spot in southern Baja Peninsula where we saw the eclipse, then back. So a 48-hour trip made it relatively low cost and affordable. So that's when I went. So that was my first eclipse. As I said, it was because of astronomical interest, because it was renowned to be a very rare and special sight for astronomers and stargazers to want to try to see sometime in their lifetime. So I took advantage of it. After that, I had an opportunity to get to a few more eclipses, but that was the first one. Awe-inspiring has to describe it. It's not just an astronomical sight of the sun disappearing and various features of a sun appearing only during a total eclipse. It's vastly more than that. It's practical when I view it in a natural outdoor environment. And the best example was one in 2017, which I saw in Wyoming. Viewed in a natural environment, it's a very natural, unusual thing to feel and see and watch and experience when all of nature is built into it. That is to say, temperature is dropping, sky is darkening, all creatures, birds, crickets are quieting down. So it's a very surreal experience. And so that's how I would describe it. It's not just a sight. It's not just watching it. It's really feeling it. Well, I think the funniest thing that happened was on the very first eclipse. The one in Baja, Mexico was funny. Retrospect wasn't so funny, but in the middle of the eclipse, should have been the rarest few moments of total eclipse. The Mexican Navy had a big ship off the coast, and they started launching fireworks right in the middle of the eclipse, which we thought was pretty darn strange, pretty funny. In retrospect, wasn't so funny because the cultural response has been for people to go outside and make noise to scare away the demons that are eating the sun in their mythology. And so you see a lot of native responses being to stay indoors, don't look at the eclipse, or go down the hilltop and make noise with banging pots, pans, shooting guns, etc. to scare away the creature that's eating the sun. I didn't realize any of that when I was there for the first time. So it was just a funny thing to see that everyone was staring in awe at the central part of the eclipse and then fireworks were going off. So that was rather funny.
The history of emotions as a practice looks at the variations of emotional expression. Typically, emotional history, or the history of emotions, is defined as a study of human emotions across varying cultures and periods. Then historians connect those emotions to how they are actively expressed and observed, especially when lived experiences become evident. An example of this can be noted when researching the experiences of Enlightenment-era eclipse viewers to those just the century before. Those before the Enlightenment were incredibly expressive of their emotions while viewing celestial phenomena. However, philosophers and writers of the 18th century were supposed to be stoic in their literary publications. Even with their serious undertones, it is evident that eclipses were just as intense from the 1500s to the 1800s and into the present day. That is what historian and scientist Sarah Reynolds remarks.
I've been looking a lot at like the 1700s and 1800s and how people talked about eclipses then. And one of the interesting things is that they're very confident that they are cutting edge, scientifically informed. They are in the know and they are no longer superstitious about eclipses. They know everything they need to know to go out and view them. And it's just a scientific thing now that they get to enjoy, but not be overwhelmed by or anything like that. So I think that kind of comes to mind that, you know, I think we always have this idea like, oh, we're ready and it won't be something too overwhelming and we're up for it. But you know, if you watch YouTube videos of even like recent eclipses and you just watch people's reaction, even the most sort of staid observer, a lot of times when that period of totality hits, is just sort of reduced to, wow, they're screaming and stuff like that. So I think that scientifically, there's a lot exciting about it. And again, it brings in those emotions and gets us interested. These kinds of events also have a tendency to sort of motivate people to go into science or study science more, maybe makes us ask new questions. You can't control the fact that sometimes your emotions are overwhelmed by a strong experience, regardless of how in the know you really are.
What is the relation between emotion and memory? Well, even though we know there is not a physical dog, snake, or frog eating the sun during an eclipse, it does not stop the traditions of making noise to scare off such creatures. In Mexico, these traditions retain the same value even with scientific advancement, even though these methods in which they are implemented change over time. Now, instead of feeding on rocks and pans, the country instead honors these traditions by lighting off fireworks. People no longer have to stay inside their homes if they have the proper equipment to shield their eyes. Yet sometimes obtaining space sunglasses or welding grade covers can be difficult, so some may wish to experience eclipses indoors. This is an emotional evolution of those wanting to protect themselves out of fear to those wanting to stay safe due to scientific knowledge. Traditions are honored without fear and replaced with excitement. When experiencing the fireworks launched by the Mexican Navy, Dempsey mentioned how he was nervous at first, then surprised, and then finally joyful during the experience. We can imagine those in the past had similar complicated emotions when viewing their first eclipse.
Thank you for listening to Eclipsing History.
This episode was designed and recorded by Alana Graves, Hope London, and Trenton Nelson, students of the Public History Program at Bowling Green State University, under the direction of Cheryl Dong and Amilcar Chalou. Midstory mixed and edited the episode. We thank our interviewees, Frank Dempsey, Sarah Reynolds, and Esteban Rios.
Landon Cena composed the original music for the podcast. Ohio Humanities provided financial support. To access other episodes and additional content, go to bgsu.edu/eclipsinghistory.